Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. More than 33 million people across the United States have lost their jobs due to the coronavirus crisis. And in a country where half of health coverage is connected to jobs, people are also losing their health insurance. The Economic Policy Institute estimates that almost 13 million people have lost their health insurance. The consulting firm Health Management Associates forecasts that up to 35 million people could eventually lose their insurance because of this pandemic. That's on top of the 27.5 million who are already uninsured before COVID-19. So with so many newly unemployed and newly uninsured, what are people supposed to do? What options are available? The calls for some version of Medicare for All are louder than ever. We just hit the 10-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, and the Trump administration is still going after it, so there's a lot to talk about today. Trudy Lieberman is an award-winning health journalist and contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. She writes for and is a contributing editor to the Center for Health Journalism out of the University of Southern California. Sorry about that. She was previously the president of the Association of Healthcare Journalists and an adjunct professor at the CUNY School of Public Health. And Trudy joins us from her home in Manhattan. Hi, Trudy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Rose.
Well, Trudy, it's always great to have you. I just want to ask you, since you are in the epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic, how are you and your loved ones doing there?
Well, we're doing fine. I have not been out of the apartment going on 8 weeks. So we're doing what the governor has asked us to do, and hopefully at some point this summer we will be out of this. But I think it's really important that we stay put right now and do what we're supposed to get rid of this thing, because it's kind of dangerous outside.
Right. And, you know, since you brought that up, Trudy, I wanted to ask you a question about a piece I just heard on NPR. And I just want to open this so I get the names of the guests right. An economist at the University of Michigan and Eric Toner, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. They were talking about reopening the country. And they said what really concerns them most is that in places that are starting to reopen, we could see spikes in the next couple months, and that could result in another countrywide closure. I mean, I know this is not your expertise, but what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I listen to the governor of New York every day, and he's worried about that too. And he's been counseling us for weeks now that we just have to stay the course, because he doesn't want another spike like this, and that's a real possibility. If people start loosening up and they go outside without masks on and go to the parks and do all those fun things that we like to do in the summer, we very well may backtrack, and I think he's trying to prevent that. Other governors have made other decisions, and I think it's going to take a little while before we see what really happens. But I'm a very risk-averse person, and I'm sort of glad I'm where I'm at right now.
Well, and the other thing, I just want to give a shout out to the nurses, because they held a White House protest this morning to honor fallen nurses on the front lines of the pandemic. And it's a very powerful visual. There's a group of nurses wearing red, and then in between them, there are empty white shoes to represent all of the nurses who have died from COVID-19.
Well, I think that is very powerful. And I think that one thing that has come out of this, I think that the American people are learning to really respect the people who put their lives on the line to try to help them and to ameliorate this very serious problem that we haven't as a country ever faced, in recent times anyway. And I think that there is a new respect for the transit workers, the people who do the street cleaning, the people who really are out there, and, of course, people in the hospital who have risked their lives every single day, especially the ER doctors and the emergency room nurses and all those people. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really good that they're having this, and that it's bringing this issue home to the American people, that there's a lot of goodness here, and that we need to respect all of that.
Well, and if you'd like to see the photos and the video of this morning's protest for fallen nurses on the front lines in front of the White House, you can go to the National Nurses United Facebook page or their website. Trudy, when you're on the show, and you've been on the show many times over the years, we usually ask you at the end about solutions. And I just want to flip that around, because the calls for some kind of health care for all are louder than ever, especially because so many people are losing their insurance that's connected to their jobs. And I was just curious about profits. The American Prospect has a piece out called "Trump Helps Health Insurers Swell Their Profits." And then the Star Tribune had a piece last week about United Health's CEO David Wichmann making more than $52 million just last year. $52 million. That's just one CEO's pay who, you know, runs a health insurance company. I mean, Trudy, it's just the system is so broken. You know, when we have you on, we can spend hours just talking about the intricacies of Medicare and Part D and all of the supplements you can buy. So what are your thoughts about where we are today?
Well, I do think that we are further advanced as a country trying to change or thinking about changing our health care, our health insurance arrangements. And I have really, in all my years of covering this, and this is, you know, 40-some years now, I have never seen this much interest, this much willingness to look at either other country systems or looking at different ways we can do things. There's just a more willingness. There's something that has happened. And I would date this from about 2017, when I first noticed that there was a shift in this country. Up until then, there was all these fights going on about the Affordable Care Act, but something in that moment happened in the spring of 2017, when all the members of Congress went home to their town halls, and the town halls were not very successful for Republicans. The townspeople, the country people, they all kind of went to these town halls, and they said that their insurance arrangements were not working for them. The ACA, in many cases, was not working. They really wanted something else. So there was a willingness to tap into some other kind of arrangement. And I know I documented all of this for Columbia Journalism Review at the time, but in my mind, that time period was a pivotal moment. And I think that has continued over the past 3.5-4 years now. And I think it's going to continue. It's almost like the train has left the station, to use an old cliche here. But I think that the public is ready for some kind of leadership on the national level that would galvanize where we are at this moment. And I'm thinking back in terms of our history, that when we've had leaders who've stepped up to the plate in these kind of moments when they've been able to pass progressive legislation. And I think about Lyndon Johnson and how he got Medicare passed and so on. And I think that is what has to happen. It probably will happen at some point. I don't know when. But I think this pandemic and the numbers that you just read at the beginning of the hour are illustrative of why there needs to be some change and why the public is really ready for some kind of change. And I think up until the moment of the pandemic, that forces that did not want this change, and that includes the insurance industry and the medical establishment and a lot of other people, were willing to sort of say, we're going to keep going along as usual. The employer system is working just fine, until it wasn't working just fine. And I think that you can make a very good argument that with all these people who are losing their coverage, and some of it has been very good coverage for them over the years, and some of them are losing less good coverage because the insurance premiums have gotten so high and coverage has diminished in some cases that employer coverage is not necessarily as good as it used to be across the board. And I think that there's this change that's going on, and I think that is all to the good for the American people.
You do have a number of progressive politicians calling for some kind of, in the case of Bernie Sanders, an expanded and improved Medicare for all. And then you have people like Joe Biden. I was just searching to find out, you know, where he stands. NPR reported a couple of weeks ago that he supports lowering Medicare's eligibility age to 60. Do you know anything else about where Biden stands on health care and the crucial changes that are needed?
I mean, I've seen him or his surrogates have been saying that he sort of supports lowering the Medicare eligibility age to age 60, but also at one point he was supporting a public option. And of course, the public option, as your viewers may recall from the days of fighting for the ACA, was something that was going to be added to that as a way that people could buy into the ACA and have the government back their insurance or pay for their insurance or however it was going to be constructed. And, of course, that was squelched in the congressional debate over the ACA pretty early on and was off the table by the time that the bill was really getting ready to pass. For a lot of political reasons, a lot of people didn't want it because they thought it was a lot of special interests didn't want it because they thought it was a foot in the door toward a more national health insurance system. And so that was basically why it didn't happen. But Biden has sort of come back and said he kind of supports that, whatever that means. So there seems to be a willingness on his part to at least think about other options. We don't know right now whether the ACA is going to survive or not. It's going to be up to the Supreme Court in the next several months to decide that. We know the administration is hostile to the health law. We also know that there are problems with the health law, and maybe we can talk about a few of them on this show because they affect a lot of people who are going to be uninsured or are uninsured now. And I think that these changes will propel us in a different direction. And I think if that's the good that comes out of this, then maybe that is a wonderful thing.
Hmm. Well, since you brought up the ACA and Trump, just yesterday he said he wants to continue to toss out all of the Affordable Care Act. He said, quote, "We want to terminate health care under Obamacare. Obamacare, we run it really well, but running it great, it's still lousy health care." I'm not sure exactly what that means, but the Washington Post reports that even Attorney General William Barr has privately argued that parts of the law should be preserved amid a pandemic. I mean, we're in an election year, Trudy, and so many people are struggling, even the people who have health insurance still. According to a new study by Harvard, even they are having a hard time affording doctor visits and other essential services because of soaring costs. So do you have a timeline on when we can expect a decision on the ACA?
I think they're going to hear argument in the fall, and so I would expect at the end of that term, I guess next June, we will have a decision. I think that that's the timetable. So I think it'll be a while yet, and I do think the Affordable Care Act will be with us for a while. And I think the takeaway right now is that people need to understand what it can and cannot do for you in this time of uninsurance, shall we say.
You know, it just hit me, Trudy, because we've been focusing on COVID-19 since February. It just hit me that the election is only 6 months away.
It is, and I think that the health insurance may be an issue in the election, that we really might have a huge issue, an election issue that is going to talk about health insurance. And I think that would be all to the good if we really got all of these issues out on the table and people knew what they were and understood them and the press was able to explain them clearly and other people would set aside their own interests and prejudices and really deliver good information to the American people and let them know what's really at stake here. Because everything's at stake in terms of their health arrangements. We have Medicare that's at stake, we have Medicaid that's at stake, and the ACA. So all of our health arrangements are really up for grabs.
Trudy Lieberman is an award-winning health journalist and contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. You can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a health insurance story you'd like to share, if you lost your job and lost your health insurance because of COVID-19, what has your experience been like in trying to find alternatives? And if you have any general questions about whatever it is, Medicaid, Medicare, the changes you'd like to see, Trudy is really an expert on these issues. She's been covering health for more than 40 years. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Trudy, we've been doing shows over the past couple of weeks, and years, but this really just, the problems are just expounded because of COVID, where you've got massive lines at food banks, small business owners are really struggling, you know, people are just struggling across the board. And in your recent piece for the Center for Health Journalism, you write, "The pandemic in the U.S. has laid bare the deficiencies in our main vehicle for providing health insurance, employer-based coverage." So let's just talk about this.
Okay.
So we've got now almost 13 million people without insurance because they lost their jobs, but those numbers are likely to go up.
Well, we don't have a lot of good options for those people, I'm afraid. We have something called COBRA. Excuse me. COBRA was a law that was passed during the Reagan administration, and the idea behind COBRA was that if an employee lost his or her job, they would be entitled to stay on their employer's policy for 18 months, longer in some specialized cases. But the big catch was that they had to pay all of the premium plus a 2% administrative fee. Well, in 1985, that might have been doable for many people because health insurance didn't cost so much, medical care didn't cost so much in 1985. However, in our current situation, both the cost of health care and the cost of health insurance are really through the roof, and that most people who are laid off from a job, or I would wager virtually everyone unless they're independently wealthy, are not going to be able to afford to stay on the employer's plan and pay the premiums under COBRA, especially when you consider that the average premium for an employer plan last year was $20,500. Now, I don't know how many laid off workers are going to be able to pay that $20,500 plus the administrative fee when there's no income coming in. Now, when they're still employed, the employer pays much of that, and the employee pays much less. Last year, the average worker paid about $6,000. So that was doable. But right now, you have to look at the finances of the typical family that has been laid off, and I can't believe that anybody's going to be able to pay those COBRA premiums. So we have to really rule out COBRA as a possibility for people to stay on their employer plan, unless they're really wealthy or have income that's stashed away somewhere. So that really brings us to a couple of other options, which I can go through for you.
Sure, and let me just give one example with COBRA since you started with that, Trudy. NPR recently reported on a woman, Mayra Jimenez, who lost her server job. She's 35. She lives in San Francisco. She has a chronic health condition, and just one of her medications costs $18,000 a year. And she said, "I was in panic mode, scrambling to get coverage." She learned that COBRA would cost her $426 a month, which is almost half of her rent. She says she brought in too much from unemployment to qualify for Medicaid, so she picked out a plan on the ACA exchange where she's eligible for generous subsidies. It's going to cost her about $80 a month, and she gets to keep her doctors.
Well, like, she's very lucky. We can start with the ACA because people like that person can be helped by the ACA. So I like to divide the people who are likely to be helped by the ACA in this circumstance and those for which it is more problematic. the people with very low incomes, like the woman that you talked about, are really going to do quite well if they try for a policy on their health exchange. And that is because the ACA provides for what are called premium subsidies, which means that part of the premium or all of the premium may be paid for under the ACA for these very low-income people. And the other thing that's very helpful to them is that there are these cost-sharing subsidies. And that's kind of a wonky term, but what it really means is that the deductibles and the coinsurance and the copays that many of these policies have, and I should add they're generally very high these days, are being taken care of for families and individuals with incomes below 250% of the federal poverty level. So that means that people with sort of middling incomes are going to do all right with an ACA policy, that if your income is, say, below $62,000, you're going to be eligible for some of these subsidies, and that is really going to be your best option. But say your income was much higher than that, and you're not going to be eligible for those subsidies, and you're out of work, and then you have to pay the high premiums, and some of them are very high in various states, including New York, and the cost sharing if you get sick. So I would argue that those people in that upper tier are not going to benefit as much from an ACA policy as the lady you described.
Also, Trudy, can you just quickly talk about the Trump administration refusing to open ACA markets? In one of your latest pieces, you write, if the administration reopened the federal health insurance marketplace, that would have made it somewhat easier for people to apply and get covered. It chose not to.
Right. Open enrollment closed quite a while ago, and the states, including California, I believe, that operated their own exchanges opted to keep them open during the pandemic so that people could apply to their states and get an Obamacare policy through their state exchange. And there, I believe, were 11 states that did that or were eligible to do that. But the vast majority of states did not, because they don't operate their own exchange. So in those states, people... they could still get an Obamacare policy through a special enrollment period, process, I should say. But it's a little bit more cumbersome, a little more documentation, a little more difficult to do, but it still can be done. And I think it's very state-dependent. So people who want to apply for an Obamacare policy need to know what the rules are in their own state, and then go to the federal healthcare.gov website and look at how to do the special enrollment, because I believe, that they can still get a policy.
Well, again, it just adds more confusion to the system. So if you live in California, Colorado, Connecticut, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Nevada, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, Washington State, and Washington, D.C., you can sign up for the ACA.
It's easier in those states.
Right.
But you can sign up in any state, and you can go through the special enrollment procedure in any state. But it's a little easier if you sign up in California or New York than it's going to be in Nebraska or Iowa.
We're speaking today with Trudy Lieberman about the healthcare crisis in this country. Trudy has been writing about healthcare for more than 40 years. She's an award-winning health journalist and contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it is our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss the economic impact of the pandemic on Italy and other hard-hit European countries. In the second the show, we'll talk about Dr. Rick Bright, a former high-ranking U.S. scientist who filed a whistleblower complaint accusing the Trump administration of wrongdoing and funding potentially dangerous drugs by those with political connections. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about health insurance in the U.S., almost 13 million people have lost their health insurance because it was connected to the job that they lost due to COVID. If you have lost your health insurance, we'd love to hear from you about what you've been able to find. If you're underinsured, how are you coping right now? And if you have any suggestions or any stories to share, we'd love to hear from you, and also solutions. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Survey data from the Kaiser Family Foundation finds that cooks, waiters and waitresses, sales workers and cashiers are some of the jobs with the highest uninsured rates in the United States. The food service industry has the most workers on Medicaid, with about 1.4 million people already covered by the government program. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS. Hey. Welcome to the show.
Hello there, Rose. Hello, Trudy. Yeah, what I call it is universal health care. You know, we're all in this together. God, when are we going to wake up and realize that as a species, you know, we need to take care of one another? We're a tribal, you know, culture anyway. Anyway, personally, the line in this is just there's safety in numbers. If we took 330 million people, adults, women and children, and just spread it out across the entire population, you know, it wouldn't cost anybody too much, and people would be covered. They'd just be covered. Some people would be unhappy with the idea that federal government probably would want to set payments for certain kinds of diseases and whatnot. But anyway, so that's one thing, is we're all in this together. Then the second one, and this is going to, you know, ruffle a lot of feathers, but insurance companies have a role to play, but perhaps not with health care. Insurance companies, to me, all they are is they're like a gatekeeper. They stand between us, the regular people, and the medical community, and they collect a fee for being the gatekeeper. You know, what fine for fire insurance, flood insurance, renter's insurance, life insurance in particular, but I see no reason why we shouldn't just eliminate the middleman. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, GS. Nice to hear from you. What's your response, Trudy?
Oh, I think the caller is spot on. That's exactly right. In the countries that have national health insurance, they pay small amounts of money, and everybody is covered. There's a pooling that's going on throughout the whole population. And I want to point out that's exactly what we're doing with Medicare. All of us have paid into Medicare all of our working lives. And in return, when we reach age 65, we're entitled to a benefit. It works exactly that way in the Social Security system, that we've paid in since the time we got our first job. And then at age 62, if you take early benefits, you are entitled to a benefit. And that cross-subsidization that's going on and that pooling of the risk is what makes those programs work and why they're so popular. And I do want to point out, you mentioned Italy, I guess, in the break, was that I've just been doing a piece on Italy. I interviewed a reporter I know very well in Milan, and she was comparing and contrasting some of the things that were going on there. I mean, they had a rough time of it for a long time, and some things they did well that we haven't quite done yet. But the one thing that they didn't have to worry about was whether they were going to have any bills to pay if they ended up, you know, really sick in the hospital, because they have a national system. And I think that that has been taken out of the equation. Out of all these countries that we see have had various degrees of success or problems in dealing with the virus. So I think your caller is just spot on, and that's exactly what needs to happen.
Trudy, you reminded me, I was in Italy in October and needed a prescription. It was a Saturday, and a lot of people said in Italian, and it was pretty amazing actually that I got it done, but I ended up going to a hospital, finding a doctor. He saw me for 25 minutes. He wrote me out a prescription. Everything cost $25. That was it. And then we had a nice conversation about the health system in the U.S. versus Italy. He didn't pay one cent to go to medical school.
Yeah, that's been my experience in Europe as well. I once was in England and needed an antibiotic for a chest thing that didn't go away after they had made sure that I needed the antibiotic. And so I said, well, what do I pay? They said, oh, it's free for anybody over age 60. And I said, even visitors? They said, yes. So there is,
well,
that's the contrast that we're dealing with here.
Right. Well, thank you for the call, GS. Any other comments about other systems that stand out for you, Trudy? I mean, you know, all these other countries have various versions of Medicare for All. Some have their own issues and problems. But as you say, the United States just pays so much for an inferior product. Any other countries stand out for you?
Well, I've looked at quite a few of them over the years, and I've been on fellowships to various countries. And I've never come away from any one of them saying that the people in those countries were having bad health outcomes. Some of them are better than others. The German system, I was doing interviews in Germany last fall, and I was just astonished at what they were talking about. And I walked away from this interview with a researcher there, and she couldn't believe our system, and I had sort of known the German system, so I can believe it. But it just functioned much better. And I guess Germany may be one of the countries that is going to come out faster than some others. But I think the one thing that they did not have to worry about is who was going to pay the bills. And I think the people who have been very sick in these hospitals are going to have a day of reckoning when those bills come due, because several weeks in an ICU with this kind of ventilator treatment is very, very expensive. And if they don't have a really good insurance policy, they're going to end up paying a fair amount of that, particularly if they have to start worrying about whether all those doctors that kept coming in and out of their room were in or out of network. And the point is, who's going to ask whether the doctor was in or out of network? Their families couldn't be with them. The person is intubated. They weren't going to ask. The nurses and doctors are trying to keep them alive. That wasn't their job. But those bills are going to come. And I think that when that happens, people might realize some of the deficiencies in our system.
Well, to that point, Trudy, the Washington Post reported on April 3rd that the administration was planning to pay hospitals for treating uninsured patients, relying on part of a $100 billion fund Congress recently designated for hospitals and other providers of health care. But there are no details yet. Do you know anything about this?
No, I really don't. I know that the hospitals in New York have been pushing for all the help they can get from the federal government. I don't know the details, but I think that's something that we journalists need to be looking at, because does that really mean that the federal government's going to pay all these zillions of dollars for all these cases? I don't know. I can tell you from my own experience that these are very, very expensive illnesses, these respiratory things. And families don't have that kind of money. And I'm
right.
Sure that many of their insurance plans are not that good.
Well, and in that piece, Larry Levitt, Kaiser's executive VP for health policy, said that even if the administration distributes these funds, uninsured payments would still be on the hook for bills from doctors who treat them in the hospital.
Yeah.
So we'll continue trying to find answers about that one. Today, we're speaking with Trudy Lieberman. She's been covering healthcare for more than 40 years. She's an award-winning journalist and contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. She also writes for the Center for Health Journalism. If you have any questions for Trudy, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go next to Dan in San Francisco. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love the show. Listen, I'm just curious about, like, the history of insurance, corporate insurance, and this and that, and where did politicians that were against it historically, where did they drop the ball? And also, you know, maybe it's partly, where did voters drop the ball on that? And like, what? I don't know. It's like I'm unemployed now, and it's like, what? I don't know. It's like, well, what can I do?
Dan, what are you doing for health insurance, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm with the city and county of San Francisco's poor people's insurance, I guess.
Okay, is that's pretty good insurance, right?
Yeah, it's decent. I mean, I'm grateful for it. I haven't had to use it so much yet, but I'm still once I generate any income or whatever, I won't be able to qualify for it.
Right. Well, Dan, sorry, I'm so sorry you lost your job. Thank you for calling. I think it's a great question. Trudy, what's your response?
Well, I'm going to give you a brief history of how we got here. The employer health insurance system began after World War II, and it was pretty much an arrangement made between unions and employers, particularly at the old line, factory, manufacturing, auto, steel, all of those industries that were really very important at that time. And they decided that they would get together and offer as a benefit this new product. It wasn't so new, but it was sort of new, I guess. And they would offer that as a benefit in the negotiations with these contracts that the unions were making with these big old line industries. And so our insurance system was really sort of born in the late 1940s, when employers would say, I can offer you great coverage and this great salary in order for you to come to work for me. They were looking for workers after the war. So during the 50s, this just kind of grew up, and other industries also adopted this kind of health insurance. So it really gained a foothold and was, you know, had great tentacles that still have, they still have a hold on it today. And as far as the 1960s were concerned, the administration of Lyndon Johnson tried very hard to get national health insurance. And in the end, Johnson couldn't do it. The Congress was blocking it, largely because the doctors, the American Medical Association, and some of the big Blue Cross plans, they were not keen on this. So the only thing Johnson was able to get was Medicare and Medicaid. The two programs were passed together. One was social insurance, which is Medicare, Part A, the hospitalization, and Medicaid, which is a welfare program. So those two programs were born in the 1960s and really became the bedrock, plus the employer market, of our insurance arrangements in the country. And after the 1960s, there was a lot of talk about going the next mile and trying to get a full national health insurance program, but that never really caught on. And the whole narrative, the whole discourse in the U.S. became, we have to cut government funding, we have to cut everything in the government, we're spending too much money. So it became a budget issue rather than a way to help people kind of issue. And the idea of national health insurance, which is the term I prefer to use, kind of died, actually, and really did not come about in some form until the ACA 10, 12 years ago. And so it was really dormant for a long time. And as long as the employer insurance apparatus worked and that they could keep premiums fairly low, people didn't complain too much. You know, you had a job, you had good insurance, or pretty good insurance, and so all was right with the world. But then those arrangements started falling apart, and then we get hit with something like this pandemic, and then the weaknesses in the system are totally exposed. That's a very short history for you.
It's a great history and so important. And Trudy, at what point did premiums start to become so expensive to the point where people decided that it wasn't worth it to even have insurance?
Well, they started rising when I was really covering this for Consumer Reports in the 90s. That's when I really noticed the premiums going up, and they were pretty high. I was astonished when a family had to pay, say, $12,000 a year for coverage. I think we had those numbers, like $10,000, $12,000, in some of the studies I did. And I thought, that was a lot of money for a family in 1992 or 91. Where were they getting the money to pay this? But the business community, their employers, were really paying the bulk of it. because they were still in the mood for attracting workers with good benefits. But when the premiums got so high, because the price of medical care got so high, and that happened probably, I noticed it in the 90s, but perhaps before, and it was when all this new technology started coming in. I remember like lithotripsy machines and a lot of the new imaging machines that were coming on the market, and they may have been good in terms of diagnosing or whatever they were supposed to do, but they cost a lot of money. And all of those costs began to be fed into the insurance system. And gradually, the cost of medical care, which is the underlying cause of the rise in insurance premiums, really began to take a toll until we're in the fix we are now. The cost of medical care keeps rising. We don't know what it's going to be next year. We know some of the insurers are predicting high premiums, and some are not. And one actuary person I recently talked to was predicting more and more narrow networks and more cost-sharing on the part of the policyholder, the consumer. So that means that the consumer is going to be paying more and more for the health insurance and or the cost of their care when they get sick. And so I don't think, you know, we don't know for sure what's going to happen, so I don't really want to say that's going to happen. Something for me to look at going forward. But if that does happen, we're going to see more of this.
Do you have any idea, Trudy? We just got an email from a listener who says, any idea what premiums, what percent you expect premiums to go up next year?
No, I haven't. I couldn't put a number on it. I really couldn't. I know that I was working on a piece about the Affordable Care Act before the pandemic struck, and I had to put it aside and do stories that were more related to the current situation. But I remember many interviews that I had done before this happened with people in the insurance industry, and many of them were predicting higher premiums for next year, and that's before the pandemic. And we didn't know the extent of it at that time. On the other hand, some people are saying if people aren't going to the doctor for elective procedures, maybe the premiums will come down. I just don't know how that's going to play out yet. I think that's something we have to watch.
And briefly, Trudy, we've got a number of more questions for you, but we're almost out of time. Since you're talking about the history of healthcare, I just want to ask you, there are very powerful interests in D.C. who want to keep the system as is. The Intercept's Lee Fong reported that the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future Action is a private hospital insurance and drug industry-led group that wants to defeat state-based public option plans and diminish support for some kind of single health insurance system. Just last month, actually, this was in March, the group spent $3 million on advocacy and TV ads as the COVID crisis took shape.
Well, I'm familiar with that group. I think they are a group that one needs to watch. I think they will be very active as we go into the presidential campaign to try to promote what they want to promote, which is not any kind of national health insurance plan, I can assure you. But I do want to say one more thing before we totally run out of time, which worries me, is that we're losing a lot of small businesses in this pandemic. And we don't know how many are really going to come back. We're trying to give them supports through these various bills in Congress, stimulus bills and so forth. Some will come back, but many will not. And even the ones that come back, I'm wondering to what extent they're going to be able to offer health insurance. It's been a struggle for them in the last several years to do that. Many of them, small businesses, have been continuing to offer the coverage because they think it's the right thing to do. They feel they have a moral obligation to help their workers. But the prices have gone up, and they're really worried that they've had to increase the prices so much, it's really hurting their workers. And many of them were expressing that to me in this reporting I was doing before this happened. So I think about this one guy who runs a manufacturing operation in eastern Pennsylvania, and he makes picture frames. And he's very worker-minded, and he's offered health insurance, And he told me that his premiums went up 16% in January. And I think about him, and I think about others like him, and whether or not they are going to be able to continue to offer what they still think is fairly good coverage for their workers. Because if we see more loss in this small employer market, I'm not too worried about General Motors and, you know, the big guys. They're going to keep doing this, I'm sure. But there's a lot of people employed in this by small concerns. And I think that that's going to be the test. If those guys can't come back and provide health insurance to any great extent, I think we're going to see more and more of a push towards some kind of national program. Mm.
I want to quickly ask you about Medicaid. Here in California, we have Medi-Cal, and you need to make less than $17,609 a year for an individual,
right,
or $36,000 for a family of four. What can be done to raise these limits?
I don't have an answer to that, Rose. I think that the Medicaid story going forward is going to be more cuts in the states rather than raising limits. The states have a fair amount of discretion over this program, as well as the federal government. They jointly fund it. But I fear that the states, which are having problems with tax revenue loss because of the pandemic, are going to start cutting Medicaid benefits, and they may be changing eligibility requirements. So I'm not at all hopeful that $17,000 is going to increase to capture more people into the Medicaid fold. I'm not sure that that's what we should be looking at as a solution.
The other thing people are talking about, Trudy, is Representative Bobby Scott of Virginia, who chairs the House Committee on Education and Labor, recently proposed the Worker Health Coverage Protection Act, which would have the government cover the cost of COBRA. But a lot of critics say that this just really gives more money to the insurance industry.
Well, it certainly does. And does it really solve the long-term problem? I think that it may, if it happened, and I think there's a lot of pushback to it, if that happened, what does it solve in the long term? You know, so a few people who happen to work for big companies get their premiums paid for a while. What does that do for us next time something goes wrong?
We have a tweet from a listener who says, I come from a heavily subsidized national health system in France. The U.S. system is backward at best. It's billed for profit taking, whereas in more advanced democracies in Europe and Canada, it's construed as a public service and thus is accessible to all.
Yes, that is true. That is what the French system does, and the British system, the Italian system, Canadians. They just do it differently. And the pandemic has been very rough on many of these countries. But the one thing that people have not worried about is who's going to pay the bill.
A lot of people, Trudy, as always, whenever we do healthcare shows, are just, what is it going to take? That's, you know, where did we drop the ball, and what is it going to take to transform this system?
Well, I think the fact that we're even having the comments that we've had today is a very positive step. And I think people who feel this way and believe this way and who are going to be hurt by this system or who have already been hurt need to make that very clear to the members of Congress. It used to be, when I first started covering this stuff way back in the day and interviewed members of Congress, all of them would tell me, well, we really read our mail, but we first weigh it. And then we know how many pros and cons we're getting on this issue or that issue. And I think, you know, that's probably a good standard to think about, that if enough people get to their members of Congress with tweets or however you want to do it these days, I doubt if they weigh their mail, but they have some metric that they use to measure public opinion, sort of get the message to these people that there's something wrong, there's something rotten here that needs to be fixed. And I think maybe the voice of the people is what is really necessary here.
Well, Trudy, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you and your loved ones stay safe, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you, Rose. Always like to be on the show.
Well, we'd love to have you. Thank you. Trudy Lieberman has been covering healthcare for more than 40 years. She's an award-winning health journalist, a contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and a writer with the Center for Health Journalism. You can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. And we got an email from a listener about the cost of a coronavirus vaccine. We did a show about this a few weeks ago, and we're going to cover it again in the next couple of weeks, so we'll definitely talk about that. Thank you for the email. You can find more information about the issues that we discussed today at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping the studio running. And if you missed any of our past shows this week, we talked about COVID-19 and the U.S. food system crisis. We talked about why meat processing plants are reopening after COVID outbreaks. We're going to cover this again on Monday. We talked about janitors fighting COVID and why aren't they protected. And then yesterday we discussed nursing homes and why they became a COVID hotspot. And we talked about the homeless crisis in San Francisco. You can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss the economic impact of the pandemic on Italy and other hard-hit European countries. Later in the show, we will talk about Dr. Rick Bright, a former high-ranking U.S. scientist who filed a whistleblower complaint accusing the Trump administration of funding potentially dangerous drugs by those with political connections. That is tomorrow. You can email us with show ideas or feedback, yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.